Thank you. Now, look, the talk I'm going to be giving is a historical talk, so I want to start with Britain in the 1970s, because very often when I talk about this period, people come to me and say, oh, you know, it was great then, it was a really easy time, there were lots of things which people got right, but it'd be really difficult to recreate in America or wherever today. But what I want to just start off by emphasising is I'm talking about a time which in a lot of ways, leaving aside fascism and the far right, just in general, was a much worse historical moment than the one we're living in now. And I want to just convey a sense of that before coming on to the far right and what people were doing to try to oppose it. So I'm talking about Britain in the 1970s. I'm talking about a time when, you know, the left had been in power, when we had a Labour government, but it was a Labour government which had been very, very rapidly running out of ideas and was tanking in the polls. It was a government which had all sorts of individuals in it who'd been associated with the left often for decades. And it was a government which actually was starting, which had come into power, promising to, in the words of the Chancellor of the Exchequer in that Labour government, to tax the rich until the pip squeaked. But very rapidly in power, just become completely lost with ideas. And actually it started introducing neoliberalism, or in the terminology people used in the 70s, monetarism, but it was the same thing. So one consequence of that is we're talking about a period which saw very rapidly rising unemployment. We'd never had in Britain unemployment of more than a million. By the late 1970s, it was settled at over a million, and it was going to remain so essentially for all foreseeable future. In the late 1970s, you're talking about a time when you know, you're seeing very rapid deindustrialization. And if you think about the experiences which so many communities here have gone through, think about something like Detroit, it felt in Britain that every day was a Detroit story. By which I mean that every single newspaper article, if you pick up a newspaper in 76 or 77, every issue you pick up, there's a story about a factory closing and 2,000-3,000 people losing their jobs. And you're talking about a period, therefore, that when racism emerged, it really, really cut. It seemed to explain what was going on in people's lives. And I'll give you some examples of the stories that we had. Lots of people in this room will have heard of the Rivers of Blood speech given by a conservative politician, Enoch Powell, in 1968. He said, you know, if we don't stop black migration to Britain in 1968, if we don't, in essence, there are going to be race riots and people are going to die. And he was using America as a symbol of what would happen. You know, we'd be like all these American cities with the riots. Now, that's 1968, and that was a scandal, or that was a crisis over a group of migrants who were coming from Kenya. So we call it the Kenyan-Asian migration crisis. Through the 1970s, essentially that story recurred. So 68 Kenyan Asians, 72 Ugandan Asians, 76 Malawian Asians. And you get a moment in Britain where the entire press is just repeating endlessly this story that Britain is under siege, attacked by waves and waves of migration. And it reaches the point where the connection between some kind of initial objective reality and the story in the papers is stretched until it's a completely unreal world of myth and imagination and fear. So in 1976, there's the crisis around the Malawian Asians, and these people who are coming to Britain. Every single national newspaper in Britain, except for the papers of the extreme far left, ran stories about hundreds of thousands of migrants coming to Britain. And there were predictions about how they were going to live, what they were going to be. And it starts off initially, it's 100,000 people, then it's 200,000 people, then it's 500,000, then it's 1,000,000. The objective basis of this story was that one social worker had been called to a very small bridge town called Crawley, which is on the south coast. It's kind of near some of our transport hubs. And they found out there were a group of Malawian Asians coming to Britain. There were two families, maybe six or seven people altogether, and there was a concern that one of the kids might be some difficulty, maybe they needed some help from the social worker. And the moment this broke in the press, we were so used to, we're so familiarised with the idea that every single black person was a tide of migrants, that it was reported, even in pro-Labour newspapers like the Daily Mirror, for example, made it their front page story about these hundreds of thousands of people, and this was the first sign of a new invasion and so on. And those particular press stories took place the day before we had local elections. And in those local elections, one particular party, a party called the National Front, did very well. In Leicester, for example, they got 40,000 votes. They came within half a dozen votes getting their first people elected, not to Parliament, but elected as local councillors. In London, and you know, in London, we always like to think that London is the kind of the part of Britain where racism gets to last, and where generally things are all right. In London, the National Front stood in over 100 different constituencies for local elections and came third in 40 of them. And it became very, very apparent that the National Front was well on the way to becoming the third main party in Britain. So in a sense, what I'm talking about is a moment which is like that moment which has become depressingly familiar all across Europe in the last 3 or 4 years. That a far-right party is going to do incredibly well in elections. But in a sense, the first point I want to make is, and this helps us to kind of compare it to today, is that the National Front in many ways were the first. You know, they didn't have a model of what it was to be a successful far-right party. And today we talk about fascism, and we know what fascism is, and it's about political violence, it's about an idea about smashing the existing liberal state and replacing it with a party state that's to the worst and dominated by the right. It's about violence, it's about militia and so on. And we have an idea about a different kind of electoral right, and I hate this word populist, but if I use it, at least people know what I mean. And we have an idea that there's a populist right which to some extent denies using violence and to some extent is willing to make peace with the state. It's a little bit closer to the mainstream, but it might also ally with fascists. But we have a sense that the fascists and the populists are deep down two kind of different things. Now, one of the tragedies for the National Front, and I don't use the word tragedy like I don't want people to feel sorry for them, but was one of their tragedies, is they could never really work out whether they were a fascist party or a populist party. I mean, actually, they had continuous internal battles in the 70s and continuous changes of leadership, and one of their factions was called the Populists. So, you know, it's not anachronistic to see them like this. Now, I just want to give some examples before I come on to the success of the far right and what their roots were and what potential they had, just to give this sense of them being, like, trapped between two different ways of doing right-wing organising. Just some stories of it. The main leader of the National Front for most of its history is a man called John Tyndall, and he came from the neo-Nazi wing. But John Tyndall wasn't initially the leader of the National Front. When the National Front was set up, it was set up as an electoral party that the far right had done very well in elections in 1968. So the first thing they said when they had all their discussions about who's going to be allowed to join, who's going to be the leader of this new party, they said, all right, rule number one, we won't have any neo-Nazis in, and there's a lifetime ban on John Tyndall. And then like 2 years later, he's in, and 3 years later, he's the leader. Or to give some other examples of this, John Bean, the man who stands in Southall, who's kind of the front for this electoral strategy. He recently published his memoir, and John Bean was in the National Front, and he stayed around the far right and so on, right until, and he's old now, but he's still around. And he wrote in his memoir, you know, when I look back on this period in the National Front, what I have to admit is that I couldn't sleep. Every night I couldn't sleep. I had this nightmare I never had for like the 10 years I was in the National Front. I never had more than 1 hour's sleep. And he said, I had this dream. I'm like, maybe some of you can explain this dream because it's beyond me. It doesn't make sense to me. He said, I had this dream and I saw it in my sleep. I saw the dead from the Holocaust. I saw the people in their pyjamas. And the horror of what happened terrified me and overwhelmed me. And that was so shocking that for 10 years I couldn't sleep. But he said, I just don't understand why I had this dream. Here I was building the National Front. Why did I have this dream? Where did it come from? Or another example of this same phenomenon, there's a woman called Jenny Dodd, who'd been a founder member of the National Front, and she was at their meetings when they talked about setting up this group. And she's one of the people who said, we've got to keep Tyndall out, and then, well, you know, she lost the argument. But in 1978, 79, just when they're right under the heat of all this attack from the left and from anti-fascists, and they're really wondering what we're going to do, what they're going to do with themselves, Jenny Doyle writes to her friend Richard and says, Richard, I need your help. We can still save the National Front, but the problem with the National Front is that everyone sees us as Nazis. You know, for God's sake, we've got to get rid of the Nazis and then we'll be all right. And she writes to her friend Richard, now some people have been saying that, you know, that you might not be an ally in this. So I want to know, are you all right? Because I think you're a populist like me. You're not one of these horrible Nazis. She sends the letter to a man called Richard Verrill. And Richard Verrill's just published a pamphlet called Did 6 Million Really Die? Which is the leading Holocaust denial pamphlet in Britain and Europe for the next 20 or 30 years. And she literally does not know that this guy's a neo-Nazi. Because he's wandering around presenting himself to her as just a normal far-right populist, something that's normal, that's different. So I'm talking about a party that's stuck. It kind of doesn't want to be a fascist party, but doesn't know what being a successful non-fascist party on the far-right means. But what I want to convey now is how well it's doing. I've talked about the votes that the National Front got. But it wasn't just an electoral party. The National Front Party was also an extremely violent party. When it went into areas, it kind of served to legitimise violence in the heads of people who already just wanted to be violent, but the National Front was doing well, and so it gave them an excuse for the way they were going already. An example I always use is a man called Fred Challis. Now, Fred Challis in 1977 was arrested and ultimately successfully prosecuted for the murder of an Asian man, and he'd killed this man's head by smashing it against the wall and then taking the blood and writing on the wall, NF rules okay. So Fred Challis is an extremely violent person. He probably wasn't actually a member of the National Front. That's kind of the weird things about these far-right parties. You don't have to be a member, but if it's successful, it gives you an excuse for the way you're going already. But for me, the thing about Fred Challis isn't Fred Challis, it's this. We used to have a practice that what the police would do is if crime took place and they wanted to boost the crime recording figures, when someone pleaded guilty to a crime, they'd get all the other crimes of the same sort in the immediate area and they'd plead guilty to them too. And that was their way of sort of boosting the conviction rates for the police and for the person who's pleading guilty. Oh yeah, no, I'm really taking it seriously, I'm very, very guilty. And people would end up pleading guilty, maybe to crimes they hadn't done, as just a way of, that was how the police did things then. When Fred Challis pleaded guilty, he asked for 300 other attempted murders in the East End to be taken into consideration. 300 GBHs and attempted murders. In other words, racist attacks were operating in that part of London at that rate that you could have one area in the last 12 months have been 300 attacks of that degree of violence, that he could plausibly say, oh yeah, it's all the same thing. The other thing to say about the National Front is they had all manner of roots in working class communities, in estates, on football grounds. I'll come on to music. A lot of what I'll say is going to be about music. But also, before I get to music, I want to talk about factories and workplaces. Because the early 70s was a period of a lot of strikes, and a lot of strikes in Britain. You know, in 1972, we had a general strike which came within a whisker of bringing down a Conservative government. We'd had all manner of strikes, and a whole number of our strikes were strikes by black and Asian workers who were going into workplaces, and the factories operated the sorts of things which you know far better than I would, which is policies of racial segregation of earnings. So you come into a factory and you might get £50 a day if you're black, and that'd be your starting salary, or £50 a week, doesn't matter. But if you're white, you'd get a starting salary of £70 a week, that there'd be grades, and the meaning to a different grade as you went into factory was just the colour of your skin. Now, in the 70s, we had a whole bunch of strikes against that sort of policy of racial segregation. But one of the particularly evil geniuses of the National Front is when those strikes happened, is they'd always appear, and they'd appear as the champion of the white foreman, the managers and the white workers who believed in racial segregation and believed in that pay differentiation. So you had kind of strikes against strikes at Imperial Typewriters, at Mansfield Hosiery. And you've had a number of National Front election candidates with people who'd stood behind banners saying, white workers of Imperial Typewriters say, unite, but unite against black people. And that was the National Front's sort of modus operandi. It'd go in when there was a campaign for equality and try and mobilise the people who were against that equality. And that includes in the workplaces. Now, one other place where, in a sense, this political battle was white hot was in the music world. I'm going to come on and talk about what anti-racists and anti-fascists did in the music scene, but I want to start off by saying that to comprehend the 1970s, you have to understand that there was a deep fascination with the memory of the Second World War and Holocaust. And this shaped even a bunch of bands that people listened to then on the left, and even a bunch of bands which we listen to now. That sense that this was everywhere in the music scene is extremely keen. And I'm going to talk about two of the people who were seen to be embodying that. But you know, literally, I could give 100 different examples from, you know, the Sex Pistols, who at their breakthrough moment, they go on TV, and half of them wearing swastikas. I could talk about The Clash, and I will talk about The Clash, but The Clash were, in a sense, almost the heroic band in Britain in the 1970s. Mick Jones, what's the name of his band before he's in The Clash? It's the London SS. And this is just universal, this sense. It's not a fascination which goes, I want a copy, or it's not yet a fascination which goes, I want a copy, but it's just a fascination with fascism. All right, so 1976, the first thing which really terrifies the left, in terms of the left that's cultural and musical, is when David Bowie, and David Bowie, you know, he's one of us, he's a good guy. He fucked up and he apologised. But David Bowie in 76, first of all, he gets photographed coming back to London after doing a bunch of films, and it looks like he's giving a fascist salute. And the music press reports it as hail and farewell. And then straight afterwards, he gives an interview for Playboy magazine. Now, to my mind, it's already getting slightly sleazy before I go any further. But what he does with the interview is he says a number of things about... He says he is a fascist. He says Britain needs fascism. And he describes Hitler as the first rock and roll superstar. Now, OK, that's pretty scuzzy. And that's summer 76. What follows just a few days afterwards is a man called Eric Clapton, who's built his whole career out of playing rhythm blues. Eric Clapton is not a good guy. He never apologised. But Eric Clapton interrupts one of his gigs in Birmingham, and he gives this kind of drunken racist tirade. You can actually find people who've tried to reconstruct it on YouTube, and they sort of turn into 2.5 minutes of adding together all the different testimonies of what Eric Clapton said. But honestly, that's to give him more credit, you know? It just gives this drunken, ridiculous racist threat, basically saying, vote Enoch Powell, we've got to kick them out, and there's all sorts of people in the audience. There's white people in the audience, there's black people in the audience going, what the fuck, Eric Clapton? The first organising that takes place against this is a letter that's signed by a man called photographer, Red Saunders, David Saunders. He's a lovely, great big bear of a guy. And he writes a letter to the press, music press, saying, we need a rank and file movement against the racist poison in rock music. Who shot the sheriff, Eric? As sure as hell's wasn't you. But what I'll start off by conveying is that, you know, this movement that starts Rock Against Racism, it does not start with 70 people, it does not start with 1,000 people, it does not start with 50,000 people. It starts with Red running around his friends to try and get them to sign a letter. And like 9 of them sign, and only one of them is at all political apart from Red. They're people he knows through radical theatre, they're his agent, there's literally somebody he stops in the corridor, there's like, he's got a little photographer studio, there's a jeweller next door, he gets the jeweller to sign it. This is not a mass movement, okay? It's not something unapproachable and impossible. It's just literally them and their 6 mates, and they write this open letter, and a lot of people write back. 500,000 people write back saying, yeah, we want to be part of this thing you're setting up that's going to be called Rock Against Racism. Now, Rock Against Racism starts off, and there are all these people, one set up Rock Against Racism groups, and you know, what's a Rock Against Racism group? We're friends, we're a letter, we don't know yet. But people start putting on gigs, and the gigs are starting to grow. They happen in London, they happen in Leeds, they happen in about half a dozen places around the country. So people start thinking, what's the infrastructure that you could have for like a very nascent emerging movement? So they say, well, okay, well, we need to have a newsletter. And the newsletter is called Temporary Hoarding. And I just want to quote from the first issue of Temporary Hoarding and the article that's written there by an East End doctor, a man called Dave Widgery. And he writes a piece which kind of becomes their manifesto called What is Racism? He says racism is as British as Biggles and baked beans. You grow up anti-black with the Gollywogs and the Jam, the black and white minstrel show on TV, and CSC history in schools. Racism is about Jubilee mugs and Rule Britannia and how we won the war. It would be pathetic if it hadn't killed and injured and brutalised so many lives and if it wasn't starting all over again. The problem is not just the new fascists from the master race whose idea of heroism is ambushing single black folks on darkened streets. These private attacks whose intentions to cow won't work if the community they seek to terrorise instead organises to defeat them. But when the state backs up racialism, it's different. Outwardly respectable, but inside fired with the same mentality and the same fears, the bigger danger is the racist magistrates with the cold, sneering authority, the immigration men who mock an Asian mother as she gives birth to a dead child on their office floor, policemen for whom answering back is a crime and every black kid is a challenge. And I still think you read that today, I still think that writing's electric. Now what... One of the clues to what Rock Against Racism was about was just that word, Rock Against Racism. I started talking about the National Front, but this is Rock Against Racism. This is Rock Against Institutional Racism, against all forms of racism. And another thing that's really important about Rock Against Racism is they set off very early on with the idea that ultimately they're going to put on gigs and benefits, but they weren't putting on the gigs and benefits for the left. They were putting them to get people along who might be pulled by the right. And this is a really important part of their method. One of the things they wanted to work on was that there was a kind of part of the punk milieu which is kind of emerging, separate but not yet totally separate, which is the skinhead music scene. And skinheads listen to black music, they listen to Jamaican music. And the idea that Rock Against Racism wanted to shove into the skinheads' eyes forefront is, how can you say you like black music and be for the deportation of black people from Britain? It does not work. And right from the start, they set out about courting bands that had often had quite left-wing people involved in terms of the musicians, but had right-wing people in their entourage. And when I mean right-wing, I mean Nazis. They had Nazis who were their liggers, they had Nazis who would do their stages, and they wanted those people to be on Rock Against Racism stages and arguing with their own audiences. So another feature of Rock Against Racism gigs right from the start is they always end in a fist fight. You know, because you're trying to fight with half the audience. You're not excluding people from the door, you're inviting them in, and then you're arguing with them, and they argue back. All right, so that's Rock Against Racism. How about the rest of the left? Because I'm talking about them, but it's about both. The by 1976 or 1977, if you were an activist on the left, you were just fighting constant clashes with the far right. If you wanted to have... if you wanted to sell a paper, then you had to have people doing security for your paper sale. What you're doing on Friday nights and Saturday nights, you'd be thinking, all right, we're doing defence of a local area where there are being racist attacks, so we're, you know, the people who live in that area, they're already forming like self-defence groups, we're coming along to support them. We're trying to occupy key areas, like say Brick Lane and London's East End, we're trying to occupy it, so literally the fascists can't go there, and we're holding it overnight, midnight, 1, 2 in the morning. And that's just what... You know, through my book, I talk about all sorts of different cities. Birmingham, Bristol, Oxford, Bradford. And I can go through if people, you know, maybe people from those cities want to talk about what happened there in terms of the battles. But this all builds up to a key conflict. A key demonstration comes in summer 77 in Lewisham, which is in southeast London. Now... The thing about Lewisham is it all starts, it doesn't start with the National Front, it's kind of like I've talked about those strikes, the National Front comes in where there's already a movement against racism in the factories. Lewisham almost starts in a similar way, that it doesn't start with the National Front, it starts with the police. And the police are under this kind of ideological pressure from the press to clamp down on this crime of mugging. But one of the mysterious things about mugging is that mugging doesn't have a definition or a meaning. I mean, it has a real meaning, which is theft done by black people. But there's no mugging could take place in your home, can take place in the street, can be violent, can be non-violent, it can be anything, but it's something done by a black person. So the police, as part of this sort of campaign against mugging, go into, they smash up 18 homes which just got people in them. Some of them, the people who've got a history, have been accused in the past of theft, some haven't. And you get a family's defence campaign starting from the families, say, we're against this treatment of our youth. And you get 18 families, the Lewisham 18 defence campaign, and then the National Front hear about it and say, all right, we'll have a march against mugging. Now, one thing this means from the start is that the left knows the families who are doing these protests, supports them, is seen to be real allies in the struggle. So when the left says, we've got a protest against the National Front, there are people in the community and it connects. But for the right, for the National Front, they don't have that. At no point do they think, oh, we'll find a mugging victim and we'll make her the poster child for this campaign. They just will do this from the outside, it doesn't matter. So for the whole summer building up to it, people in the community, the left, trying to organise against the Front. The Front come along, they get 800 people on their march. When their leader's Martin Webster, he does the talk, and he goes around on the megaphone saying, well, most important thing, don't get into any fights with the left. And as you ever, you know that speech, it means do get into fights. So they show up, people waiting for them, there's a crowd of about 2,000 anti-fascists, attack, run down the hill, smash into the National Front assembly point, tear out of the hands of the National Front supporters the banners they've come on the march with. They have an honour guard who's supposed to be the most violent, psyched up people. They have their own banner. Little bits of things which look like carpet can be found after this in every black household in South East London because that banner is torn into shreds and distributed amongst the community. National Front disperse. They're just about to get to march together again, and then they try and march through Lewisham. As they do, more and more people streaming out of the houses, music's playing, saying stand up, and people confront them, find the National Front, reach their last fantôme, and they turn round central Lewisham. There's still just about 800 of them, and they see 5,000 or 10,000 people waiting for them, and there is no way they're going to pass. And they're led off into down into the streets, give this desperate speech, you know, for God's sake, the police are going to need to have automatic weapons if we're going to get through a crowd like that. And they disperse. And it's still, ever since then, it's been a talking point for the right. That was their defeat. It's the last time they tried to march in any significant numbers through a black community in Britain, because they know that they'll get their asses kicked if they try it again. And they knew it then, and they've known it ever since. But this isn't, you know, for everyone who's on the march, it feels like we had a victory, and you know that it's been a victory. But that victory's still got to be banked. It's not obvious it's going to be won, because what happens is that evening, the press launches into an attack on the left. The Midnight News opens with this image of a 60-year-old woman. She was a member of the National Front. She had been on a lot of marches in the past. And like in shock and horror as this tidal wave of humanity had attacked her. And we get every single national newspaper, we get the Labour Party that's in government, the Home Secretary, all of them denouncing the anti-fascist protesters. The left has in recent years been banned in different countries, not in Britain, but for example in France. And certainly the only discussion in the press is, well, obviously we've got to discuss all left-wing demos for the foreseeable future, but should we also discuss the left-wing groups? And, you know, well, one talking head says, well, we should ban them, and another says, well, we should tolerate them. But that's the level of the public discussion in the aftermath of Lewisham. Now, it's at that point that the left settles on a strategy, which is actually, it's a sensible one and it's a right one, but it's actually a strategy of, to some extent, taking a step of retreat. And that's something which when people on the left have explained this part of the story, they don't explain it properly. There's actually, to some extent, a retreat that the groups on the far left who are most associated with that protest, particularly the Socialist Workers' Party that's been a large part of it, say, we're going to ally with the Labour left. We need, to some extent, to have that shield of association with people who are closer to the mainstream. Because if there is going to be a press attack on anti-fascists, this is going to be on a scale, and we're not big enough to push all that back, while we've also got now the National Front bombing our headquarters and stuff like that. So there's a retreat, but it's a principled retreat. There's no giving up on the politics. There's no, all right, okay, we're coming along to the Labour Party, and the deal is we won't demonstrate anymore. Now, the deal is we're going to have demonstrations and you're going to be the other people, and you're going to be other people sponsoring them. And we're going to carry on fighting the right. And to some extent, that deal's won through. So you get the far left and the Labour Party, or at least the Labour left, agreeing on this thing, which is going to be the Anti-Nazi League. And that becomes a mass movement. 50,000 people join, 30 national unions affiliate, you know, somewhere over 500 local chapters of unions affiliate. And that sets up a pattern. It's going to go through, and there are two more things I'm going to go through before, if I can, before I sum up. The next step the movement takes is actually it goes back into culture. What this new anti-Nazi league needs to be doing something to give this mass movement a practical expression. And what people settle on is a form which is mass carnivals. And because this is the left, people start with really low ambitions. You know, well, maybe we get one truck and it could drive through London with some music playing on it. And the rock and roll people go, yeah, that's great. We like the idea of carnival and we like the idea of music, but can we think a bit bigger? And then a bit bigger, and then a bit bigger. And can we keep on thinking? And they go for, put it in a park. We go for something that can hold not just tens, but potentially hundreds of thousands of people. Think, what are the most exciting political bands of the day? And go for the best of ones, the very most exciting ones, the most political ones, the people who are emerging, and bring them and make them headline. And you get carnivals with hundreds, with two in London, with 100,000 people in each of them. And there are lots of stories you could tell, but I'll just tell one, which is the story. One of the organisers, because this is going through East End, which is where Mosley had his base in the 30s, it's where the far right's been organising in the 70s. And one of the organisers just finds himself chatting to the woman who runs a sweet shop in that area. And she's been there ever since the 30s, and she's Jewish. And she comes out of the shop and she stands there for 6 hours watching as a crowd goes past marching to the carnival, every moment thinking, at last, there are people here are on my side. And of course, the National Front have theirs too, but they're like 20 people drinking in the Blaybones pub, drinking themselves into a stupor as they watch this enormous crowd going past too. And the other thing this builds up to is the 1979 election where the National Front stands. The only thing which will hold them together now is standing in elections. They can't go on the streets, they'll just get smashed, they stand in elections. They stand 300 candidates, the average vote is less than 1%. Where they stand and they've stood before, their vote falls by between half and three quarters compared to where it's been before. And by the end of 1979, that the organisation has split three ways and suffered a defeat from which it doesn't recover, or its successors don't recover for 15 or 20 years, if not longer. But I want to end kind of like with three points, if I can, and I'll try and do them all quickly. The first one's about culture. I went to a lovely meeting here earlier this week. It was about horror. It's a really good talk. I'm not criticising the speaker, but someone said in passing, you know, when we talk about culture, we're not talking about the really important stuff. You know, the really important stuff is politics, but culture matters, but it's just not the most important thing. What I want to emphasise is this is all about culture. You know, the musicians needed Rock Against Racism because to their extent, there are musicians, Joe Strummer, the lead singer and guitarist of The Clash. He's someone whose brother had been in the National Front and killed himself. Joe Strummer needed politics to solve the shit that he was dealing with in his own life. And he needed political people who talked about culture to solve the musical problems they faced. If you've listened to early punk, and I know there's some fans in here, but you know, sometimes it's like you're listening to 100 different British bands and all they're listening to is the Ramones. You know, What the cultural people needed Rock Against Racism and that idea that black and white musicians would always play together every single night. That transformed them musically. And they respected the left because the left had answers to them on the terrain of culture. But if it had just been politicos and it hadn't been culture, none of this would have won. You know, the National Front had 17,500 members and an awful lot of them were willing and ready for a fight. The far-left groups, the International Socialists, later the SWP, who were an important part of both Rock Against Racism and the Anti-Nazi League, had, 3,000 members, 4,000 members? You know, if it had just been our hard cases against their hard cases, we would have lost. So culture was essential. Culture was the thing that changed the balance of forces. The next thing, I'll do this in just a sentence. This wasn't just about anti-fascism. You know, the anti-Nazi League had a politics which was defeat the Nazis, defeat the fascists, defeat, you know, we've got to do this so that the left can have a space to breathe. But Rock Against Racism was broader. And you could not have had that takeoff, that sense of a whole generation of people, hundreds of thousands of people being involved in mass movement, if it had only been the anti-Nazi politics. It was the relationship between the anti-Nazi and the anti-racist politics. And again, I've talked about anti-racism. Even racism isn't actually the totality. One of the things I talk about in my book is how Rock Against Racism realised, oh my God, we're putting on a bunch of gigs with sexist musicians and we're going to have a Rock Against Sexism too. I don't have time to convey it. Maybe this is something that should come up in the discussion. But people realise it's got to be against all forms of oppression and that became absolutely core to their politics. And the last point I want to make is this: it's about what it is to be a revolutionary. Because I've come here these few days and really enjoyed it, and it's been really intriguing hearing lots of people say, "I'm a revolutionary, I'm a socialist, and I'm a revolutionary," and that's good. But I suppose it's, what does that word revolutionary mean? I think on the left, it's very easy to kind of get yourself tied up in a knot, which says the job of a revolutionary is to make a revolution. So we propagandize for the idea there should be a revolution, and then if there's another workers' revolution, we've done our job. But you know, like the last one was in 1917 or maybe in 1936. Maybe you can be a good revolutionary even if actually you didn't happen to live through a revolution. Maybe the point of a revolutionary is you go into every mass movement you could be in and you say at every point, raise the ambitions, raise the stakes, make that mass movement, or you know what, maybe make that mini movement and you're the organizer. Make that, have a sense about it, foreshadow the possibility of revolution. Because that was the spirit within which the organizers of Rock Against Racism worked. And I think that's a spirit can be used in lots of other different circumstances too.